The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors: Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card that generates leads. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet and Fetch Pro, the secure, high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. And Printify, the online, on-demand print shop for all your corporate merchandise. Be sure to visit our online store and get your own podcast merch. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
So in 2014, I had an interesting conversation with one of my existing investors who was looking to put some more money into internet businesses. And I was at the time thinking about ways that we can test a studio model for building businesses. And a studio model is a little different from building a single startup because you ultimately are trying to create a number of ideas at a time. And so we had some good conversations, and I had at the time a partner in CrowdSpring who I later bought out, who ran CrowdSpring for a period of time. So I left to focus on this new studio model, startup founder.
Like an incubator
full-time
kind of an idea? No,
not like an incubator. So here's the difference.
Okay.
What we were doing, we hired our own team.
Right.
We came up with our own ideas. We put together teams to build these ideas and launch these businesses. And the idea was that when we would launch these businesses, we would bring in outside people to run them, or somebody on our team would run them. We would provide outside funding or get outside funding beyond our seed capital that we were giving them. And then turn them into companies that could stand alone and that will have a portfolio of businesses throughout. There are some really great examples of this around the country, successful studios, BetaWorks in New York. There's Science Inc. in California that's had some phenomenal successes. Expo has done some good stuff. Lots of good examples. Idea Lab is probably one of the earliest in this space.
Okay.
We had this theme that we were following. We wanted to build really big, significant projects. And so we were tackling complex industries. And it was one of these things, moonshots, effectively. We knew that we could fail if we didn't ultimately get enough traction, because these were really big bets. So
the information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit BeinhackerLaw.com, or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hi, my name is Ross Kimborowski. I'm the founder and CEO of CrowdSpring. CrowdSpring helps entrepreneurs, businesses, agencies, and nonprofits with everything from custom logo design to packaging design, web design, and even naming businesses for every stage of their growing business. We believe that great design doesn't have to cost thousands of dollars. Prices start at $299, including all fees, in a different model where you pick from among actual designs for your new business. You pick the one you like.
All right, so we're on the microphone live, and this is on YouTube, so people can see your machine in the background. Thanks for coming on, Russ. We were just talking that Jason Byers with your organization, he had reached out to me to get you on the podcast. I know this took a while, so I appreciate you spending a Friday afternoon with me. It's actually a little early where you are, right, by an hour?
It's right. It's 2:30. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Mitchell, and with your audience.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So let's get, I know you mentioned in your opening that, you know, you founded and you run CrowdSpring, but I know you've done other things, other entrepreneurial ventures. Maybe we go back and tell your backstory a little bit and how you got to where you are, and then we'll get into CrowdSpring.
Sure. So I started my life as an attorney.
Don't tell too many people that.
I actually, so interestingly enough,
you're a recovered attorney.
So this is interesting because a lot of people feel that attorneys who leave the practice of law are recovering attorneys or left because they were frustrated. And I had a very unusual situation. I had remarkable colleagues and clients, and I didn't leave because I was frustrated with the practice of law. I actually was very, very happy. I left because, I mean, listen, your show is called The Accidental Entrepreneur.
Right.
And in essence, that was why I left. I became an accidental entrepreneur. So I started practicing in 95 when the internet had just become commercialized. And because I was always a big technology geek, I built, you know, hundreds of computers myself, and I hacked with lots of video cards and home theater PCs.
Sure.
I felt like the internet was a good place for me to start learning, but I was a trial attorney. So I spent most of my time in complex commercial intellectual property litigation. I did some regulatory work early in my career.
Okay.
But because I was interested in technology, I also started doing work for internet companies. And part of the benefit and the beauty of starting out in something new where nobody knows anything better than you do, we didn't have any partners at my law firm who knew the internet, who understand commerce, who understood computers. And so I had a chance to build a practice with technology startups from the first year that I became a lawyer.
And it wasn't litigation, right? It was helping.
And it wasn't litigation at all. It was all transactional work. It was all counseling on, you know, so this is the time when nobody really knew what most of the terms we take for granted today are, like e-commerce and you know, databases and other things in the technology space. And so I would have clients call up and say, I'm meeting with, you know, a global bank in 2 days about a potential deal where we're going to be doing X, and I need some bullet points, and then I'm going to need a contract. And so there were no forms. There were no examples. And so you had to do this all from scratch. But it was interesting because it was a chance to talk to really smart entrepreneurs who seized the opportunity.
Right.
And a chance for me to understand that market a little better. And so anyway, I spent most of my legal career, 13 years, doing both complex commercial and intellectual property litigation, trying cases across the country and trying trademark and patent infringement cases everywhere. And also about 15% of my work always continued to be working with startups, mostly transactional work for startups, because I really enjoyed it and I like the change of pace there. And so for me, that experience was interesting because I had, for years as an attorney, tried to start a company where I said, I really want to start something. Let's come up with an idea.
Even while you were practicing?
Even while I was practicing, it was just something that was driving me. And, part of the reason why I say I became an accidental entrepreneur is because that effort to try to start something actually didn't materialize, didn't result in anything. And the pinnacle was in, I think it was in 1999 at the Consumer Electronics Show, where my brother and I stood outside the People PC room and heard their pitch where they said, we're going to give away a free PC to everybody and make money by advertising. And we looked at each other and in jest said, well, why don't we give away two free PCs and make double the money they're going to make?
Right.
And after laughing for a few minutes, we realized that this was just a terrible, terrible idea. And we didn't really have anything. So I continued to practice, but I ultimately ran into a problem.
And that, you said, was from 95 till about 2008? That's about 13 years.
2006 is when I got the idea for CrowdSpring. So I continued to maintain a full legal practice to the end of 2007. But in 2006, I was a partner at a mid-sized Chicago firm, and I was leading the redesign of our website. So it was a passion for me because when I started practicing law in 95, I hand-coded one of the first law firm websites on the internet. And so this was a chance to help another firm, my second firm, improve.
Right. And there weren't all the tools we have today to make a website. You had to do it by hand, right?
So we went through this typical process for small, mid-sized businesses. We put together a document of what we need. We interviewed agencies who did
like an RFP
for websites. RFP.
Yeah.
And we picked one. We paid them a lot of money. they spent 2 months working on something and we had this big meeting and I hated their work. And I was very frustrated and ultimately embarrassed because I had to go show this to my partners. So I went home and I really, in that frustration, thought there's got to be a better way for people like me, my clients, to buy creative services, because the concept of paying a lot of money up front to somebody that may have a pretty good reputation, but then really not liking what they do was troubling me. And so I stumbled on this idea that over the next 6 months I tested that ultimately became CrowdSpring, which is today a global marketplace for design and business naming work. But at the time it was just an idea. Anyway, I worked on this idea for 6 months. We launched it as a business in early 2017, publicly launched in mid 2018. I maintained my legal practice. I tried cases. I did depositions around the world until the end of 2017.
Keep the money coming in, right?
Well, it was a combination of things.
You liked it too.
I liked it. And I had some really, really complex patent infringement cases. And there were no other attorneys in my firm that could easily at the time take them over. So part of what I had to do was I had to
finish
help
them
train
up.
And finish these cases or take them to a place where they could be taken over.
Right.
And so I did that. But when I could no longer do both, I left to focus on CrowdSpring full time.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. There's several startups that did that in several industries. If you take what's that framing company where she went online, she went to buy a frame. It's like ridiculous. The amount you pay more for the frame in these stores than you do for the picture. Actually these are Warby Parker. The eyeglass industry is nuts. It's like controlled by one company or two or three companies and you overpay for everything. So I think there's a bunch of examples of that and people have taken advantage. There's also one I think that did it in the invitation space or something. But yeah, I think you recognize, like, just because the creative group's a good group, they got a good reputation, doesn't mean that what they're going to create for you is going to be what you're looking for. And you end up paying an arm and a leg for it. I guess they really work with larger corporations, not small.
And that was a struggle. And so we were trying to cut prices, which we ended up cutting prices 10 to 50 times less than the market. And really the frustration, because even today there are marketplaces like Upwork where you can go hire a freelancer, where people are bidding against each other based on price. But listen, price doesn't tell you very much about the quality of somebody's work.
Right.
The quality of somebody's work tells you everything you need to know, which is why CrowdSpring reversed that model. So instead of looking at bids and proposals, when you need a new logo design, you pay $299 and you pick from dozens of actual logo designs for your business. It's like shopping for shirts or televisions or cars. You pick the one you like.
Yeah.
And that model is really attractive to any person that tries it.
Well, you know, it makes sense because I've used Freelancer and Upwork before and you have to try people out. Like you have to hire somebody and see if they do a good job and then try someone else. You really do. And you don't have a chance to try them out or see their kind of work ahead of time.
Right. And so there are professions where this isn't possible. You're a lawyer. And so it's not possible to have four lawyers try your case at the same time.
Right.
And so there are times when you can't do it, but there are times when you can. And so in the creative space, for example, agencies have often done this for decades where they would ask freelancers on spec to do some designs for a prospective client or for an actual client,
right,
and they'd pick the one you want. So what we wanted to do was bring this power to empower business owners to have the same access to a global talent pool.
Yeah, it makes sense. So how did you start building that talent pool?
So it took us, it took us about a year to launch. And of course, we made the first mistake we made was literally on day one, because having just had this experience with this agency for my law firm, our first decision was to hire an agency to build our new website.
Right.
And you could probably guess, and I bet every listener at this point is smiling and probably laughing because they all know where we ended up. We didn't at the time. We ended up in a situation where we hated their work. Unsurprisingly.
Right.
And
you're proving your own hypothesis.
Well, and we had this conversation. We sat around the table saying, well, this is terrible. We have to launch in 6 weeks. Their work is absolutely horrible. We are going to be embarrassed if we launch this. What do we do? And so we decided that our first project on CrowdSpring was going to be to design our own website. So if it failed, our business failed, because ultimately, if we could not accomplish this for ourselves,
how could we sell that to anybody else?
And so that was our first project. And the way we did it was in the back end, we had other smaller projects we were running for friends and family where we would reach out and say, listen, we'd love to give you a free design project. Do you need a logo for a new business or for your existing business? We'll pay for it.
Right.
So as creatives were submitting designs to this website project, when we saw talented people, we brought it into this private beta behind the scenes. And as a result, we started building a community of designers. And we were working with, you know, a dozen clients at the time, and slowly that community grew. And by the time we had a design website from somebody who happened to be from Denmark, we had, you know, several dozen clients on the site in a private beta. We had several hundred designers who were working with them, and that slowly got us to increase both. So when we were comfortable that the quality of the work met a certain threshold, we went to other friends and their friends and said, listen, we're not going to pay for the full project, but we'll pay for half of it. And after a few weeks where we were comfortable that they were getting good value, we said, we're not going to pay for any projects anymore. We're softly opening for business. We're not making a big announcement, but at this point, if anybody wants to post, they're going to have to pay us. So we had a business model from the beginning. We were interested in making money from day one because ultimately this wasn't designed to be a nonprofit, and right. We were not interested in monetizing on advertising or any other models. We wanted to sell a great service for a fair price.
Right. So both sides of the equation pay for access?
They don't. So only clients pay.
The designers get paid and the clients
The designers
pay.
Get paid. And in that way, we are very unique from almost every single competitor, both in our space and in the RFP marketplace space like Upwork. We have never charged designers anything. So 100% of the award goes to the designer. We even pay the transactional fee to send them the award. Ultimately, clients pay a fee to post these projects. They're baked into the price. So I mentioned $299 is the price right. for a custom logo. That okay. includes a $200 award to the designer and a $99 fee to us. And that's how all of our project pricing is structured.
Got it. So yeah, so you keep part of the fee and they keep whatever the fee is for that particular category.
They keep the full award, 100% of the award for the project.
Right. Do they even know what the person's paying up front? It depends.
Absolutely. So this is the other way we're fully transparent. This is the other way we're different from almost every single competitor. From day one, we've been transparent with both sides. The client, we give them a breakdown. Here's what you're going to pay. Here's how much the designer is going to get. Here's how much we're going to get. We do the same thing for the designers. So they know at all times what they're going to get, what we're going to get. Zero confusion.
Have you heard of Up Council?
I've heard of them, yes.
Yeah. They had approached me and they have this whole pitch where you pay, it's a lot of money. You're paying $1,500 a month and they get submissions and you got to pitch for the, basically, this is what you're going to charge, whatever. And it just sounded exhausting to me. She said, well, on average, 15% of the people who post actually hire an attorney. So you have to post at least 15 to 20 times a week. And I'm like, oh, I got to make a living. What if, you know, the cost versus the return and the exhaustion that it was making me feel at the chance that I might get a shot at business. Didn't make any sense to me. The whole model didn't make any sense.
Yeah. Well, that directory model, I've always been a big skeptic because I've never seen one that works very well for either side, either the people who are looking for attorneys in this example or attorneys who are looking to find clients. And you can talk about any industry, any space. I just haven't seen much in the way of a benefit to either side. The person that creates a directory, if they can get people to pay,
right.
Obviously benefit, but
right. Yeah. The guy in the middle benefits. I've gotten some people through Upwork and Freelancer for like podcast editing and stuff like that. But yeah, it's not. I think your model is very interesting. So I saw in your bio, though, you were involved in some other startups. So when did those come along? Was that?
So in 2014, I had an interesting conversation with one of my existing investors who was looking to put some more money into internet businesses. And I was at the time thinking about ways that we can test a studio model for building businesses. And a studio model is a little different from building a single startup because you ultimately are trying to create a number of ideas at a time. And so we had some good conversations and I had at the time a partner in CrowdSpring who I later bought out, who ran CrowdSpring for a period of time. So I left to focus on this new studio model, startup founder.
Is that like an incubator
full time
idea? No?
Not like an incubator. So here's the difference.
Okay.
What we were doing, we hired our own team.
Right.
We came up with our own ideas. We put together teams to build these ideas and launch these businesses. And the idea was that when we would launch these businesses, we would bring in outside people to run them, or somebody on our team would run them. We would provide outside funding or get outside funding beyond our seed capital that we were giving them, and then turn them into companies that could stand alone and that will have a portfolio of businesses throughout. There are some really great examples of this around the country. Successful studios, BetaWorks in New York, there's Science Inc. in California that's had some phenomenal successes. Expo has done some good stuff. Lots of good examples. Idea Lab is probably one of the earliest in this space.
Okay.
We had this theme that we were following. We wanted to build really big, significant projects. And so we were tackling complex industries. And it was one of these things, moonshots, effectively. We knew that we could fail if we didn't ultimately get enough traction, because these were really big bets. So just some examples, we had built and launched a marketplace for in-home elderly care that was competing against three established companies at the time, who each received, together, I guess they received about $160 million in funding. Three other companies.
Right.
And so we were competitive in that space. We got licensed in Illinois. We were operating in Wisconsin.
This a placement company? You're placing aides into a home for healthcare, or?
Yes, but we were the agency of record. So we actually had built a technology tool for getting a caregiver for 1 hour, 2 hours, 1 day, multiple weeks on demand. We were hiring only the top 2 to 3% of caregivers. Most of them had a CNA, certified nursing assistant certification, paying them about 30% higher than the market. And so very highly qualified group of people. We had about 2.5 dozen people working for us in Illinois and Wisconsin. And just ultimately, again, big moonshot, huge market, very complex, lots of demand and interest, and maybe our timing was wrong,
right.
Maybe the market was wrong. We ultimately got to a point where we were growing the business, but not fast enough to get venture funding. Ultimately, for that kind of a business, you need to get significant funding to be able to scale it. And it ultimately ended up that one player in that space ended up receiving, several hundred million of additional funding and stayed alive. Everybody else went under.
Right.
And then the other, in around 2015, we sort of pivoted with our focus in Startup Foundry on businesses that were grounded in artificial intelligence. So we were really making big bets on AI.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we lost those bets. We had two startups that we were building, and we launched some other projects, but we were two startups we were building in the AI space. One had to do with hiring and qualifying employees, and it was a very complex problem that we invested a year trying to solve. That we ultimately could not solve at the time, but we found a different path to solving a different problem that we turned our attention to, which is how to actually market effectively using in social media one-to-one, direct marketing. And so we worked on this interesting product.
That doesn't even sound close to related, what you were working on.
The technology itself was the problem that caused us to pivot in that space. So marketing has always been a passion for me.
Right.
It's something I've always been interested in. It's a problem for businesses like mine perennially. If you're a small business, one of the things that you do poorly generally is market.
Right.
You don't have marketers on staff. You can't afford it. And so we were trying to figure out, how do we solve this problem for us and other small businesses? And so we invested some energy into building that product. We actually built it. I had commitments for millions of dollars in funding. The problem for us, and this was ultimately a problem we should have understood from the beginning, the unit economics were really poor. And just for people that don't know what unit economics are, is the cost to deliver this service to people cost us more than what we could reasonably charge for it. We thought we would charge about per client. We thought we would charge about $300 to $750 a month. This was a very good, sophisticated service that still doesn't exist anywhere. But it would cost us $1,500 to $2,000 per client a month to actually deliver the service because of the complex technology needs that we would have. And so we couldn't
make that up in volume.
Exactly. And so this was like the people PC example I gave earlier.
Right. I mean, you can't, there's no such things making up in volume. If your unit cost is higher then what you're charging people per unit, doesn't matter how many units you have, you're always going to lose money.
And so that was frustrating as an entrepreneur because, had we asked that as the initial question, if we had done some modeling, we probably should have known that answer and we could have avoided spending all that time.
I mean, that wasn't even close. It wasn't like it was $375 your cost and it cost you $550 to operate. It
wasn't close. We knew that there would be some potential issues. We figured it would take us maybe a year to build, that technology costs would come down. We just didn't really appreciate the significance of how many issues that we had. So the product worked. It still works. It was inefficient to operate, and we couldn't come up with a way to do it more efficiently.
Interesting.
And so in that time, I had come back to take over CrowdSpring and run it again. And part of what we did was completely rebuild CrowdSpring from the ground up. We changed every pixel, every word of copy, all of our marketing campaigns, the entire team. When I came back, nobody on our team was with CrowdSpring when I came back in 2015.
Now, why did you do that?
Part of it was to try to rebuild the company and get the edge as a startup back. So when you work with a team for a while, some people are able to maintain that edge and think like a startup, and other people cannot. And part of what I realized is we had to improve in certain areas where we were just not as good. And part of it was making different choices. So engineering, for example, we looked at, I do this every quarter, and I advise entrepreneurs to do this all the time. Every quarter I meet with the senior team and we ask the question, if we were to build a company to compete with ourselves, what would we do?
That's a good question.
So that question involves, a number of different directions. It's not just what would we do differently. It's would we do what we're doing, actually?
Right.
Would we do something differently? Would we do something else? And so we ask that question all the time, and we happened to ask that question when I came back. And the answer was, we would change just about everything that we're doing.
Right. So your attitude is, why aren't we doing it, right?
And that's what we ended up doing. Right. We ended up changing the entire team. We rebuilt using completely different modern technologies. We had my lead designer from the studio redo the visual design for the site and the user interface and the user experience. And so we just went in a different direction. And part of that, some people weren't happy about that. And so we lost a few people to attrition. And ultimately, some people just weren't able to work with some of these new technologies. And so ultimately, we had to make some tough choices. But this is important because you get pretty stale very quickly if you're not looking to improve.
Right. So you didn't lay off everyone in the company. You just shifted some things around. You said there were some people left from attrition. Some people just didn't fit within the new directive or whatever you want to call it. But other people stayed. You didn't clean house with everybody, or you
did not clean house. People stayed, but we ended up over the next year and a half ultimately turning over everybody in the company.
Interesting. That was with your partner that you bought out when you came back.
Well, he was gone by then. So the day I came back, he was already gone.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000. That's LAW to 21000 to learn how to get your own digital business card. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their affiliate link on our website to learn more and get connected with Fetch. Printify is the online service that simplifies and automates the process of sourcing and creating print-on-demand products branded with your company logo, product, or service. Printify is a better alternative to pre-purchasing and warehousing your merchandise for distribution or sale. Follow their link from our website to learn how to set up your own online store. And be sure to visit our online store and get yourself some podcast merch. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
Interesting. So if I can go back a little bit, what were you studying before law school? What were you in college and stuff like that?
So I ultimately got my degrees in political science and philosophy, a BA in political science and a BA in philosophy, two majors from Northwestern University. And so both, I knew I was going to law school. I was passionate about law. I was a competitive high school debater, nationally ranked. I was a competitive college debater, only for 2 years though. I didn't debate my sophomore, junior year in college. And so I knew I wanted to go to law school. Philosophy and political science were perfectly good majors. As a prerequisite history for majors. That.
So you went straight to law school.
Straight to law school.
Yeah, me too. All right. Well, I would like to know what you think. Two things. One is, let's talk a little bit about CrowdSpring. Like, what do you think the challenges that you're facing, that you've had faced with the pandemic? Maybe it's been, I don't know, there's some people that's been gangbusters for them. And maybe then we could talk a little bit about the things you've learned as an entrepreneur and a tech entrepreneur and a startup specialist, if you will. I mean, you've done a lot of that stuff and kind of things you could share with people who are listening. Like, if they're thinking of starting something up, things like you just gave a very good, tidbit about on a quarterly basis, asking those kind of questions. But let's go back to CrowdSpring. What kind of challenges have you faced through the pandemic and the things that have gone over the last couple of years?
So our business has expanded significantly from the time we launched. Just to give you a perspective, today, we have clients from 100 countries. We have over 220,000 designers and namers in 195 countries, pretty much every country in the world. Our predominant clients are small businesses, 1 to 9 employees. That's for whom we built CrowdSpring.
Of course.
That's who predominantly uses CrowdSpring. But we're really fortunate because we work with a lot of Fortune 500 companies. We work with many agencies. We work with lots of nonprofits. So when the pandemic hit, there were some things that didn't impact us and some things that did. We had from day one been a distributed team, largely influenced by the fact that we never cared about where people were. We were really significantly motivated by hiring the best people anywhere we can find them. And a lot of that was driven by influence from really strong companies, you know, companies like Basecamp in Chicago, who had done this for years before us.
Right.
And in the process of building a distributed team, we always had to focus a lot of our energies on remote. So we had an office pretty much all the time through the end of 2017, when I finally gave up the office in Chicago, because I was the only one going into the office. And
Everyone was looking at different places, right?
It made no sense for me to drive 45 minutes into the city to go to an office where I would sit by myself.
Right.
So you're wasting an
hour and a half of your day.
Exactly.
To be alone.
So in that sense, we were not impacted. There was no transition for us.
Right.
You guys were virtual to begin with.
Right.
We were comfortable. We had all the communication tools set up. We had a really good flow. But we were impacted for the first couple of months significantly by the fact that our clients were an absolute shock.
And yeah, they didn't even know they're going to be in business again. Right.
So because we work with lots of industries, so the restaurant industry, the food and beverage industry,
right?
Technology is one of these industries, but photographers, event producers.
Yeah, they were all struggling.
Everybody was struggling. Their businesses were shut down or they had limited ability to do anything. They couldn't plan. They were losing money. And so for a period of time, it was really difficult to understand. So as soon as this happened, we recognized this would be the case. And fortunately, one of the things that we've made many mistakes along the way, but one of the things we've done really well is we've run our business under budget every month. So we focus on making sure that we're spending money where it's appropriate. So we do the best that we can for compensating our team. We do the best that we can to find the right tools for them and make sure that they're not wanting for things that help them do their jobs better, but we're not extravagant. We never had a fancy office. We don't, spend money on silly things. And so that allowed us to weather the storm of 2020 because ultimately, we didn't have to tighten the purse strings. We already were operating pretty frugally and that served us really well. But it impacted our clients. And so that created, issues. Some of our clients were not able to run their businesses. And something like, I think, 20% of businesses closed within the first 3 to 4 months of the pandemic, at least in the U.S. And then we also had challenges with our creative community because they were all over the world, but they were dealing with these real issues of if they lived in a place that didn't have reliable electricity in their home, they would work outside the home somewhere, but they couldn't because
they couldn't, right.
Countries were sheltering
no
and
internet cafe,
sometimes, you know,
right?
People got sick. And so, yeah. So it created challenges that we had to overcome and solve. And our team focused on that and dealt with those challenges. And a lot of that was about, you know, being human, understanding that sometimes, you know, people couldn't meet their deadlines simply because, you know, they were in the hospital after they were infected by COVID or a family member was. And so involved a lot of conversations with clients, with creatives, managing expectations and making sure that, you know, people understood that this was a very unusual situation.
So did cash flow obviously went down, but then did it come back? Because I know there's been a significant amount of business startups, not necessarily tech startups, but business startups after we got past the first 4 to 6 months. I've seen a big uptick in people opening businesses. They were furloughed, whatever, and they're starting up. Have you seen the cash flow kind of in your business? Because you're the, you know, people get started. They need a logo. They need this. They need that. I think it would follow the startup trend, right?
We did see it rebound. We saw it starting to rebound in the
fall,
you know, towards the end of the second quarter, beginning of the third quarter, and then more aggressively rebound in the third quarter and into the fall. But ultimately, you know, it depends on where. So different countries experience the situation differently, and also depends on states and cities, because, you know, startup people were starting companies. And this is one thing that I struggle in these trends, because I've seen the same trends that you've been seeing. So the U.S. Census is responsible for reporting most of these statistics for the past, I think, 4 to 5 months. And we're seeing the aggregated statistics, something like 493,000 businesses were started in the, I believe, in the last quarter of 2020,
which
is 30% more than the year before.
Right.
Here's the challenge. What they're not talking about and what's impossible to understand is whether these businesses were started and then started operating. So people may have registered businesses, but could have been a restaurant, but they couldn't operate. It could have been a photographer business, but they couldn't do anything. So I have not seen any good metrics for that. So we did see a rebound, but I suspect that for the typical American business, it's still a huge struggle. And certainly for certain industries like restaurants, food and events, businesses in most states, it's still incredibly painful.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the statistics are very misleading. They talk about, you know, businesses making it to the second year and the fifth year. A lot of that data comes from bank accounts that close and things like that. But just because we close a bank, there's plenty of businesses that, first of all, struggle, but there's also ones that close bank accounts and they don't go out of business. The entity still exists and maybe becomes something else, or they pivot. So, yeah, a lot of the data is a little bit misleading. But as a lawyer, as a small business attorney, that's what I, in the United States and in New Jersey, that's exactly what I saw. It was dead, literally dead for 3 or 4 months because businesses didn't know they were going to be open. And then the summertime, it peaked a little bit more, dipped a little bit coming into the fall again because we had an upsurge in what was going on and the whole country was in chaos. And, you know, in New Jersey, New York, and maybe in your area, too, things were relatively well managed by local governments, health departments. You know, it wasn't like the craziness that's going on in Florida. It was going on in Texas and all these other places. It wasn't happening in New Jersey. So restaurants are still at low capacity. I mean, it's just difficult. But I've seen a big in the last, what are we in, February now, coming into March? I've seen a big uptick in the last 90 days of activity on my side of the small business world.
And that's great to see. Listen, one of the interesting statistics that I've always looked at very with a lot of fascination is that some of the most successful businesses have started during periods of economic decline.
And
it's interesting why. And part of that is because, you know, people don't have a choice. They may have lost their jobs. And so they start something new.
Necessity is the mother of invention, right?
They become an accidental entrepreneur.
Right, exactly. And it was just the timing. And, you know, maybe they should have done it. Look, there's a lot of people who should have done things a long time ago, but they didn't feel in their heart. I guess they didn't feel comfortable enough. They had This gave a lot of people permission to make changes in their life. And kind of in their mind, blame it on other people. Well, I had to do that. That's why I did it. As opposed to saying, I took a risk and it didn't. Why did you do that? And then it didn't work out. Now, if it didn't work out, it didn't matter because you could blame other people, I think.
That's very possible. That's the driver.
Yeah. So is the restaurant industry by you open? I mean, what are they at, like 20%, 30% capacity, something like that?
I think it depends where. So in like the Chicago.
Like in Chicago, downtown Chicago.
So downtown Chicago, I think is at 25 or 50%. Like so it's still limited. I think 50% is currently, it's still limited.
Right.
And it's tough for a restaurant. I mean, restaurant businesses are low margins. And so
very low
running margins. A restaurant at 50% capacity is
no, you're below crying. Cost. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a 20 to 30% margin maybe at the most.
Yeah. So we're seeing some phenomenal restaurants go out of business and, you know, it's frustrating to see because, these are businesses of passion for the owners, for the chefs, but they can't survive for a year or
they
don't more.
They didn't have the capital resources. Yeah. And you and I both have the same problem. You can't do outdoor dining right now. So that makes it worse. You know, I mean, you could, I would get to sit in one of those igloos with a heater. I just think they're going to. It's just not.
And they have, I mean, there are a few in Chicago, but I mean, it's hard in the suburbs. It gets harder because they don't have nearly as much space oftentimes. And it's just still, even at 50%, because I think that there's still, you can't build 100 igloos next to your space. You could put two or three.
Yeah. New York is basically, I don't think they're at 50. I think they're at like 30, 35. And you can't, a restaurant, as you can imagine, I'm sure Chicago is very similar. The margins on restaurants, if you're in New York City, are very slim. It's a lifestyle business, basically, you know, and there's a lot of restaurants or a lot of businesses that, you know, cash flow, as you know, hides a lot of things. If the money's flowing, you can make mistakes and you can be. And then when the cash flow stops, you realize, oh, my God, I'm killing myself to run this business. I'm making no money. So I think there's a lot of people also decided to not go back and rebuild their restaurant or whatever it happens to be. I've seen a lot of partnerships, though. I've seen people partner. Some people had money. Who lent them to some people didn't have the money to get their business started. Maybe they bought a share of the restaurant, try and get it back on its feet, kind of like, you know, private equity investment in small business, which generally hasn't happened. I don't know if you've seen that by you, but you got to be creative in these times, right?
And I think ultimately, we're going to see these industries rebound over time. It's not going to be quick for a restaurant industry because the capital expenses are significant and people are going to be struggling for a while to figure out how to raise the capital to do it. And for most restaurant investors, it's not a good investment. So they're not going to put money into risky venture, but we'll see that come back. People obviously love to eat and love to eat out.
Yeah. The industry will come back. It's just who gets crushed in the process.
Yeah.
You know, there's a diner. What's the one near Broadway? The Stardust Diner, which has got all the singing waiters and waitresses because they work on Broadway. So they got hit twice, right? They can't be on Broadway and the restaurants are closed where they make their real income. Well, that diner will probably come back, but not with the owner who had it before because he lost everything.
And this is true. I mean, listen, it's just not just the restaurant industry, obviously the actors and, you know, Broadway shows and theaters and photographers and people who put on events and weddings and none of that has been happening in most places. And it's impacted significantly so many people in so many industries.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's my question. You built a company, CrowdSpring, around the concept of bringing these graphic design services, basically, because that's mostly what they do, right? Graphic designers.
It's graphic design and business naming. So we have a big community of people who name businesses and products.
So if you're, so if this is what my concept is, you don't know what you're going to name the company, you can actually create not a contest, but get input from several
you
people.
We guarantee at least 100 names for your new business and you pick the one you like.
Geez, that's probably hard to pick through.
And we tell you whether the domain is available with that name too. So part of the frustration is not having done this many times. Yeah, you know, it's hard to find a business. The hard part of finding a name is finding a domain
that'll match up, right?
You know, for $299, you get 100 plus ideas, typically hundreds of names and matching domains.
Right. So you recognize that the small business owner who are a lot of them are right brain, right? We're all right brain creative types, don't have access to the kind of creativity and that bigger companies do, right? So you built this platform and you built it in a better way than the other ones are doing it. Do you see other industries that are ripe for this kind of revolution, offering some sort of service to the consumer, to the small business owner that is not available to them now?
Well, we've looked at many industries over time. So we didn't pick graphic design and naming out of the blue. We actually, at the time, asked the broad question, where is the demand highest? Where's the biggest problem? And so we looked at, we interviewed hundreds of business owners. We looked at existing marketplaces back in 2006 and 2007. It turned out that graphic design represented more than 30% of all projects that were being run online through these marketplaces. Because every business, you know, first thing they need is a business name. And it's really hard if you're an entrepreneur to get it. Once you have a name, you need a logo, you need business cards,
website.
And the thing is, you know, you can get generic templates. But the problem with generic templates is you have hundreds or thousands of other businesses using the same design, which means that people are going to confuse you. You won't be able to stand out. And so, so one thing that young business owners find out is that the cost of cheap or free design is unaffordable. You're going to end up paying so much more. And typically after a year, when you're struggling to build a strong business and you ask yourself, what's the problem? Why am I running into this problem? There may be many different problems, but one problem is you have either not investor or underinvestment in good design. Because at the end of the day, good design is good business. It helps you build a brand. And if you look at the world's best companies, branding is one of the most important reasons why they are the best. They created recognition and loyalty, and they do all of the other things well too. They build great products. They spend a lot on marketing. But when it started out, branding was a key part of beginning to tell that story.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, even from a personal standpoint, if you're a solopreneur and you do whatever you do, you have to brand yourself. Or else you just
absolutely
like everyone else, you know, and I think a lot of people miss that. So I want to point something out, though, because I think it's important for people listening to know, because I'm a big, like, you know, write a business plan, get, you know, do planning. You said that when you started CrowdSpring, maybe you didn't even have a name at the time, you did the research as to what is going on in the marketplace. And I think a lot of accidental entrepreneurs, they're committed to it. They think this is a great idea and they don't really do the market research and they don't test it. And there's a lot of easier ways to do that kind of research and testing nowadays than there was 20 or 30 years ago. And they don't do that. And they don't realize that they're running down the wrong path or not the best path, or they get down the road and they're like, ugh, boy, I wish I realized this now. I could have. And I think that's a good comment that that's how you've grown businesses, using fundamentals that say, let's do the research. Let's figure out what's going on in the marketplace. Let's figure this. Don't be so attached. I guess if it didn't make sense, you would have offered a different service, right? If you came up with the conclusion that the world needed a different service, you would have gone a different direction, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's really, really good insight. And we've written and talked about these concepts. So we have this phenomenal guide. I'm happy to share. You can add to the show notes on writing a business plan and on writing a one-page business plan.
Yeah.
But one thing that's really critical is trying to test your ideas. And here's one thing that, you know, you asked earlier, what are some things that I've learned? And this is something that I didn't learn while being an entrepreneur. It's just naturally the way we approached figuring this business out. Most 99.9% of people who are thinking about starting a new business are looking for confirming information why their idea is good.
Right.
And part of the challenge for us is something called the anchoring effect. When we initially hear something, it anchors our brains. And then everything we find, we rationalize to fit that mold.
Makes sense, right.
So we have this great idea for a business. And I've mentored thousands of entrepreneurs over the last 13 years. And I talk to them about this all the time, that we fall in love with our ideas and rarely with the problem. And the thing that you have to understand is the problem you're trying to solve, not your idea. Because if your idea is great, but there's no problem, nobody's going to buy it. So here's what we did from day one, which was different and I think helped us. And this is how I encourage people to do it. We looked for disconfirming information.
Right.
Every day we got up, our only goal was to find enough information to tell us we were wasting our time and that this idea for business would not work. And every evening when we talk, we'd say, okay, we looked for this information here, here, and here, and we were not able to find it. Instead, here's what we found. And we talked through it. And the next day, the mission was the same. Find disconfirming information. Why were we wrong?
Right.
Now, this was inadvertently for us a great way to build a business, because we didn't think of it as a business for 6 months. It was just an idea. It was a hobby. We were
trying to break
time.
It. Right.
And so when I started working on other businesses, we spend 90% of our time focusing on the problem. And only then, only when we understood the problem, will we talk about a solution to that problem. Because it doesn't matter whether you know how to solve a problem if you don't know the problem. Right. What matters is you really understand the pain. In the case of CrowdSpring, this was my pain of trying to build a website for my law firm. So I really understood it. But having talked to hundreds of other business owners after that, I saw they shared this pain.
Right, because so you didn't know at the beginning whether they had the same pain
exactly.
as you or not. Yeah, exactly. Isn't there one of the big technology companies, whether it's Google or Microsoft or Amazon or whatever, that they reward their employees for breaking whatever their idea is? They have departments that literally like take an idea and try and make it not work. I don't remember which one it is, but yeah, I think that's, look, it's very psychological and very natural for your brain, because we have protective mechanisms in our head to like what we do, like our own stuff. I mean, it's just human nature. So if you got to step out of your own skin and say, listen, I'm okay with that, and I don't want to fail, right? What's wrong with this? Talk me out of this. Tell me why this is a bad idea. And I think
that's, by the way, how we approached trying to validate it with friends and family, which most people do. They have an idea and they seek out input. And so usually, you know, most people will find friends and family and say, here's what I'm thinking about. Do you think it's a good idea? Which is the wrong question to ask, because most friends and family are going to ultimately say, honest. this is a great idea.
Yeah, you're great.
What we did instead, again, this was seemed counterintuitive to most people, but it was the only thing that made sense to us, is we put a list of the 10 smartest people we knew. And we said to them, we want to share with you an idea. We don't want you to tell us what's good about it. What we want you to do is tell us everything that's bad about it. Okay. We want harsh critique. And it worked so phenomenally well, because we had some really, really strong, significant conversations with some very smart people who poked holes everywhere. And what happened was, when we ultimately came to a point where we needed to raise money and started talking to investors, turned out that we had all the difficult conversations already.
Right.
We didn't hear a single question from a single investor that we hadn't heard from one of our friends
or
colleagues.
Answers.
And right. We now had the answers. We were very lucky that we had smart people who were able to poke holes in our idea. And so I encourage people to do that. Don't ask people, do you like this idea? But do what we did, which is to say, tell me everything you can potentially find wrong with this idea. Tell me why I shouldn't do it.
Yeah, well, that's probably good advice for people going on Shark Tank. Don't go into the tank unless you already know the answer to the question. No, Ren, you and I both know good lawyers never ask a question unless they know the answer.
Well, that's
before
true.
They ask the question, you know. And I think that you get these people on TV. I mean, obviously it's entertainment, so they pick, but they're not prepared. They're defending what they think is a great idea, and they haven't broken it themselves. But I think that's a good place to leave it. I'd love to put the link in the show notes to your what'd you say? You wrote a book or a guide?
So there's a big guide. It's about 10 to 15,000 words on writing a business plan with sample financial documents and outlines and
oh, fantastic.
All of the sections, and then one page. And we have a few other guides on starting a new business. We have a 20,000 word guide on building a brand identity, one of the most important things entrepreneurs do. I'll share these if you want to share in the show notes.
Yeah, that would be great.
That'd be really helpful for small business owners.
All right, Russ, well, I appreciate you spending your time. And I was going to say, do you have any advice for small business owners? But you gave the advice. So I think if people follow that model and they're not accident, they do things purposefully, which is exactly what you did. And don't be so in love with your idea. Figure out whether it's good or bad objectively, not subjectively. Maybe we'll have a lot more success in the world. So I appreciate you spending almost an hour with me. And stay warm and stay healthy out in Chicago. And please stay in touch.
Thanks, Mitchell. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Russ.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinheckerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.